We know that if we sprain our ankle, we believe it's going to heal within 8 weeks. But if we for some reason think, well, I got a cancer diagnosis, I can't heal from this because that's what I've been told, or I have heart failure, I can't heal from this because the heart can't heal, you start having this misconception from the get-go. And I think as soon as people start to lose hope, they lose the desire and the ability to kind of press onward when things get hard. I think for a lot of people, it gets back to hope and a belief system that if it's flawed from the beginning, you're in trouble.
Hey guys, welcome back to the podcast. If you like this podcast, please like, comment, subscribe. And I'm going to jump right into it because we have a very exciting guest, Dr. Austin Lake.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yes, I've been following you on Instagram, just loving all of your health tips and all of the knowledge that you are sharing with the world. And you are a believer,
which
I think is very important because you're view of the world will impact how you practice medicine.
Yeah.
Would you say so?
Yeah, and I think it's one of those things that I heard Simone Gold talking about this on the live broadcast, but you know, she was saying that if you go into life with this perspective that like you know everything, or that you're not supposed to be humble, or you don't have like the Holy Spirit filled inside of you, like you're not going to be able to take information as you maybe should. And I think if you're prideful about anything these days, you're going to be entrenched in a camp that is maybe going the wrong direction, and you're going to stick to it no matter what. And I think that's maybe not so healthy.
No. And that is a common trend we do see with people in medicine, is they can almost get this godlike and then mentality, and then it affects their patients. And so it is important that, you know, that the way you see people and how you treat them, and understanding that we are designed by God, and that God designed our bodies to heal themselves.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And if you have that perspective, that will also affect how you treat people.
Well, yeah. And this people use the term placebo effect with this, but really it gets back to belief, right? And so if you have a belief that you can heal, right? Like we know that if we sprain our ankle, we believe it's going to heal within 8 weeks. But if we for some reason think, well, I got a cancer diagnosis, I can't heal from this because that's what I've been told, or I have heart failure, I can't heal from this because the heart can't heal, you start having this misconception from the get-go. And I think as soon as people start to lose hope, they lose the desire and the ability to kind of press onward when things get hard. And I think for a lot of people, it gets back to hope and a belief system that if it's flawed from the beginning, you're in trouble.
Yeah. How much would you say that affects what you've seen in your own patients, their health and how they heal, if they have a belief system or maybe they have discouragement?
Yeah, I mean, they always come to me because I'm like the last line of defense. I'm this like holistic guy they found online, and it's like, I guess I'll just try him. He's my last option. And so I'm used to dealing with people that they have very little hope, and they're just trusting that maybe there's something else they could try that's different from what their conventional doctor told them to do. And so when I talk to them, I'm always coming from perspective of my experience working with real people and kind of what I've seen. And I always try to relay that to people, like, hey, you know, there's been 400 or 500 other women just like you that have reversed this, that have healed from this. So don't, like, there's no reason that you can't do this either. And I think as soon as people start to believe that I have a conviction about it, then they start to get their own conviction because, you know, there's like a mutual belief that kind of moves us forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things I was just thinking about, I mean, the other day, is I'm looking at people around me, I'm looking at people talking online, and you just hear about all these people with cancers and autoimmune diseases, which, I mean, stuff that I never really heard people talking about even 15 years ago, and it just seems like chronic illness has exploded in society. And what's crazy, it's kind of being normalized, and people just think, well, this is just the way it is.
Right.
And I'm here like, it's not normal. Right. Like, we're not supposed to have these things. Why have we seen this increase in these chronic illnesses?
Well, I mean, the obvious ones are, you know, we've relied way more on ultra-processed foods. I mean, 60% of the American diet is ultra-processed, not even processed, like the bioengineered foods, right? And so that was kind of the initial cascade, I think, from when they started using Roundup and glyphosate, and they started creating these genetically modified foods that required us to create essentially cardboard, no nutrient-dense foods. And so we start having immediate nutrient deficiencies that impairs our organ systems from functioning, that impairs our body to detoxify. We're just not going to make energy, right? And so when we have these other issues that we're faced with that would require a lot of energy from your mitochondria, now all of a sudden you're bankrupt and you have to pull from these other resources, or you can't address it. And then you start seeing disease pop up, right? And disease is really just, in my opinion at least, it's a chronic state of deficiency. Like when you have a chronic state of not having what your body needs to fight these things and heal from them, you start seeing the byproduct of that, which is typically a pathology. And so that was kind of the first thing. And then you start having a transition to, you know, the vaccine schedule increases from just, you know, a handful of shots to now like 79 shots before the age of 12. And then you have, you know, the increase of technology. You have, you know, kids are not outside of being as active as much, getting as much vitamin D from the sun. And there's just a whole host of things. And then you have parents that are busy working and, you know, they can't provide stability in the home. So they feed more convenience foods and, you know, they're not regulating sleep. They're not on top of their schedules. And, you know, it just creates a lot of chaos for the body. And for these young kids like us who kind of grew up in the 90s and, you know, now 2000s, it's like we're seeing the fruit of that or lack thereof. And that's where you start to see autoimmune conditions spike. You start seeing turbo cancers spike when you have this concoction of these different environmental toxins that are burdening the system and the system is deficient so it can't handle these things. You know, you're going to have type 1 diabetes in children happen more frequently. You're going to have type 2 diabetes happen more often. You're going to have cardiovascular issues at a younger age. You're going to have strokes and all sorts of terrible stuff. So, like, it really is just it's a soup of issues. It's not just, like, one particular thing. It's not just, like, it's Tylenol. Like, people kind of are saying, like, oh, Tylenol is causing it. It's like, well, Tylenol just makes your body detoxify less effectively. Mm-hmm. And then when you're doing that after you've had a bunch of heavy metals injected into your system and trigger an immune system response, you're going to have problems, right? And so you have to kind of look deeper than just what they're pushing in the media and start kind of asking some questions. And again, I think if you feel the Holy Spirit and you have the right resources, you can figure it out for yourself and for your own family.
Yeah, Tylenol is just one thing and many other things working together to help create that problem. You know, the thing that was crazy about the Tylenol thing was, and I'm like, medicine shouldn't be political, like health shouldn't be political. Yeah. And yet it has become that. And I'm not saying I'm against what they're doing. I love what they're doing right now in office. But like they come out and they say this could be linked to autism. And then people's response on TikTok was pregnant people taking Tylenol as like a sign of rebellion. And I was like, this is crazy.
Yeah.
Like who does that? And I'm thinking this shouldn't be a right or left thing. We should just all collectively want to be healthier.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, I was just shocked that that was some people's response, you know, but it's almost like when I had Dr. Peter McCullough on, he wrote a book about, he was saying vaccines are becoming the new religion.
Yes. I was just going to say that.
That's, really?
Yeah. Yeah. Carry on. That's great.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking. I was like, it is almost seems like a religion, the way they defend this and like big pharma and like all these things. It's like, they're just almost, it's like a faith almost.
Right. Well, I think when you have, when you put your faith in an organization or, you know, a group, you're not going to do the research yourself. You're going to do what's being passed down. And that's what happens to conventional doctors as well, is, you know, doctors don't have time to be scientists at the same time, right? Mm-hmm. Like the scientists are doing the research, kind of doing the discoveries. And then that information, the selected information is being passed down to the doctors to then be implemented for their patients. And so whenever, you know, people are like questioning doctors, it's like doctors are first going to think like, well, if I don't know this information, then nobody else knows it, because I'm like the end of the line here on this information. And yet you're saying that you can do this, and there's this holistic guy saying you can try that, and it's like, well, that's not been studied, that's not been well established. And so Hippocratic oath is to do no harm, so I'm not going to do any harm to somebody, so I'm going to do what I know is to be true, what has been passed down to me. And I think that's the same kind of religious dogma that's being implemented across all medical industries. And so, and in my opinion, that's by design. Like that's not by happenstance. Like that, there's a reason that when Rockefeller put out, you know, the Flexner Report back in 1910, that was the agenda, was to standardize medicine under the pharmacia, you know, approach. Mm-hmm. That was a petroleum-based service. And so since then we've been operating in that mindset. And I think it's going to be a lot of work for us to kind of pull the lens back or pull the veil back a little bit on kind of what people are being indoctrinated with, because it's so deeply infiltrated. It's kind of hard to speak to somebody clearly and have an honest conversation like this, because people are so indoctrinated to like they just get triggered immediately. As soon as they hear something, they're like, nope, that can't be true. Like, vaccines are safe and effective. Like, an immediate trigger word. It's just like, they don't know that for themselves, but they've been indoctrinated to say that and to believe that. And that's just, it's just not true.
They've been taught to ostracize and demonize anyone who speaks against
yeah,
it.
Quackery.
So, yeah, so if you say something, you're like, oh, they label it, oh, you're an anti-vaxxer.
Right.
That's not even true. It's like, I'm not anti
just asking
this.
Questions.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm just questioning. But you know what? It's like you said, you made a good point. It's been ingrained in society, and now this has been going on for almost probably like 100 years now since, I mean, the Rockefellers, that was the early 1900s where they got involved, and they drastically changed medicine because there used to be homeopathy, and they used to use herbs, and they used to understand getting rid of parasites, and it changed to this other system, like you said, with pharmaceutical drugs, correct?
Yeah, correct. Yeah. Yeah, and it's you know, so John Hopkins and Harvard, all these schools that are being funded by Rockefeller organizations, like, they are doing the research, right? And so it takes a lot of money to do research. Like, it doesn't happen just
and to do trials.
Like, you get people to participate. You have to, like, be able to take on the litigation, you know, the potential lawsuits. Like, you know, I won't say the word, but, you know, there's a pharmaceutical company with the name starting with Pfizer or ends with Pfizer. You know, like, they've had more litigations against them than, like, any other, you know, company. And they'll put out a product and they'll make $13 billion on it, but then they'll get penalized like $5 billion, but they're still going to profit $8 billion, right? And so, or whatever the math would be. So, like, there's that perspective where it's not just, it's like a money-making business for them.
Yeah.
And they can withstand the litigations, but most people can't withstand that. And so they can't put out the trials, they can't put out the research to get this stuff out to the public.
Yeah, because I interviewed a guy that has a nitric oxide, and he was doing the trials and stuff for it, but he had to pause because it's so expensive. And he was talking about how hard that process is to get that done. But yeah, the pharmaceutical industry is so wealthy and so powerful that I don't even think people realize how powerful it is. And when you watch, I don't really watch TV, but like, if my husband's watching football, it's probably the only time that really TV's on. Or like, if we're at the gym and it's on, I'm always shocked by how many, it's like probably 90% of the commercials are pharmaceutical commercials.
Yeah, I know.
This is going to do this. And at the end, they're like, and it will cause this, this. And it's just like, this sounds horrible. Like, why would people, but I'm like, the fact that so many people are sick and this is what people are being given as an answer.
Yeah.
And it's not, and the thing with, you know, I'm not anti- drugs necessarily. Right. The problem is, and what I love about what you do is it's not actually getting to the root problem. It's just masking a symptom.
Well, yeah. And it oftentimes will create more symptoms, right?
Yeah.
It's going to create more depletions. So it may make you feel less of whatever that symptom was, but now all of a sudden you have kidney issues, or now you have unexplained back pain, or you have, you know, joint pain or whatever. And it's just like, well, now we need a drug for that. And now you have rheumatoid arthritis, and now you have, you know, I need a hypertensive medication because you have heart disease. And it's just like, when the reality is, if somebody knew, like, hey, if I just stopped doing these four or five things, and I believe that if I stopped doing those four or five things, that I would reverse these conditions. In my opinion, at least in my experience, I've seen that most people are on board with that. They're like, oh, of course, like, this will actually work if I do this. Of course, like, sign me up. Like, I don't want to feel this way anymore. The biggest reason they don't is that they're not getting the reassurance that if they do that, it will work, right? Mm-hmm. So nobody's going to put effort into something if it's not going to produce an outcome. Like, that's craziness if you keep doing the same thing over and over again and getting no results. But if you're like, hey, I'll go to the gym, I'll train for a marathon, and if I do it this way, like, I'll get there to my end result and I'll feel accomplished. But it's like, or if I like break my wrists and I have to wear a cast for 8 weeks, like, I know it's going to heal up, then I'll rehab it. Like, now my bone's healed. But if somebody said, hey, you can reverse your autoimmune disorder by, you know, eating an elimination style diet, like detoxing from parasites and heavy metals and sleeping consistently and making sure you're breathing clean air and drinking clean water and taking these foundational supplements, like, people be like, of course, I'll fix this. Like, I don't want to feel terrible anymore. You know, I just got to believe that if I do this, it's going to work. So that's really my job with when I'm working with clients, is I have to kind of be the one to remind them, like, hey, this is going to work. Like, you just got to keep following these steps. And so people are so bombarded with information that it's hard for them to kind of, like you were saying, like, what diet do I follow and, like, what do I do? Like, distill it down to, like, what are the step-by-step process that they can follow to actually get to where they need to go. And if they don't have to think about it so much and they have confidence that I'm going to kind of guide the whole thing for them, then they all have to do is put the effort in. And then when they start getting results, they get reinforced to do that effort more and more. And I think that's what I've learned is, like, the biggest thing that's been helpful for people is just not giving them information, helping them implement the mm-hmm. right information consistently.
Yeah, changing their life, their mm-hmm. lifestyles so that their body can heal.
Right.
What would you say are the most common root causes that you see with your patients?
90% of all diseases are caused by stress, right? So
oh God.
That's most of them, right? Yeah. But it's not just, when you say stress, it's not just like what you're thinking, right? It's oxidative stress. Like that's when your body has been, something enters into your system that's not supposed to be there or causes the reaction that produces free radicals. And those free radicals are antagonistic to your cells, right? And so antioxidants fight off oxidants, you know, free radicals. And so oxidative stress is really what it boils down to. And so there's, you know, radiation, like these cameras and these things around us, our cell phones, huge, huge problem that I think we're not talking, I don't talk enough about, honestly. But all that is just a direct, constant interaction with our cellular health that causes this, you know, these ROSs, these reactive oxygenated species that cause oxidative damage. And so that starts to mess up your cell's ability to detox and to make energy. And so when you start doing that, a lot of people have type 2 diabetes, for example, they don't manage energy very well because their cellular health is so inflamed and so damaged that they don't know how to manage energy. So they start storing up fat, right? They start having excess sugar in their blood that then starts to cause damage in their, you know, their neural tissue and their lower extremities and different things like that. But the reality is it's an inflammatory problem that's happening at the cellular level. And so radiation's a big one. Obviously if you're eating food that has a bunch of these foreign chemicals that aren't supposed to be in your system, creates oxidative stress, right? It creates this inflammatory issue. You know, not sleeping is a huge one because we're so inconsistent with our sleep schedules that, you know, we'll stay up too late, we'll watch shows before bed, and then we're like, hey, I'm in bed for 8 hours or 7 hours, I should be good. But it's like, well, you slept in a broken sleep pattern from, you know, 11:30 until 6:30. Like, that's not deep, restful sleep. You're also missing the key hours between 10 and midnight of deep, restful sleep that's draining your glymph system, your glymphatic system, which is basically your glial cells and your lymphatic system. So it's basically like a metabolic waste detox that happens every night. But if you don't sleep in these hours that are super important, like 10 to midnight, you often are missing out on that benefit. And so people are, you know, they're sedating themselves with medication or alcohol or these things to kind of just like close their eyes, but they're not actually entering into the stages of sleep and rest and healing. And so your hormones are made while you're asleep, your white blood cells are made while you sleep.
Wow.
All your memory storage is happening while you're sleeping. So it's super, super important, obviously.
And that leads to the newest thing I've been researching, which is circadian rhythm.
Yeah, circadian rhythm.
I'm trying to implement that in my life. You know, looking at the sun first thing in the morning, looking at it. I have to take my contacts out because I wear contacts at night.
Yeah.
Looking when the sun's going down and then trying to not have that's so hard.
It's very hard.
Because it's not just your screens or your TV. It's like literally the lights on in your house.
Oh, everywhere. Yeah. All the LEDs, everything. Yeah, what you just hit the nail on the head. What you do in the morning is how that sets you up for a good night's sleep the next night, right? And so if you're getting early morning sunlight, because that's going to help to activate serotonin, which is going to help with your mood, appetite, energy. But then that serotonin ends up converting into melatonin when you go to bed, right? And so you want to get that supply up nice and high via the sunlight hitting your eyes. And then the other thing is just making sure you're not drinking caffeine past noon, you know, making sure you're eating breakfast. That all helps to kind of regulate your circadian rhythm. People are skipping breakfast, drinking caffeine, spiking cortisol, spiking blood sugar, and then they're kind of having the repercussions of that all day long. And I always tell my clients, like, eat 80% of your calories before 2 o'clock. So breakfast and lunch, and then have a lighter supper, dinner, whatever you guys call it. I grew up in Iowa, so we call it supper. But that's kind of like that. But if you do that, it starts to set your night up for success. So then if you take some like magnesium an hour before bed, you have your blue lights shut off about an hour before bed.
What magnesium do you like? Because there's like 4 different kinds and it's confusing.
There's like 12 different kinds. Yeah, there's a lot.
Which one do you take?
I take glycinate because it's like the jack of all trades. It's a pretty good combo. It kind of checks a lot of boxes for people. And it's also easy on the stomach, so you can take it on an empty stomach and not have nausea and things like that. So I like that one. For some people, like 5% of the population, it can energize them while they're sleeping. So like that's not a good thing. But for most people, it helps them to sleep. If you do things like that, otherwise a consistent bedtime is the most important thing. Just having a consistent bedtime. Like it's so basic. It just sounds you know, not even fun to talk about, but it's so important.
No, it's life-changing though.
It is.
Because yeah. I used to stay up super late when I was like single, then I got married and have kids. And now because of my kids, I'm on a better schedule. And I honestly feel the best if I go to sleep at like around 9.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And you wake up around 6, you feel amazing.
Yeah.
It's like the best feeling. Now, granted, with kids, your sleep, who knows what can happen right there.
Yeah, you know, you change every night.
Yeah, but when that does happen, it is the best feeling. And that takes discipline. But sleep is probably one of the best things, like you were saying, for your health. And it people are jacking up their sleep unintentionally. And I mean, of course, you want to be on social media right before bed, but that's not good for you mentally or physically.
Yeah.
Probably spiritually either. It's probably not good for us to have such... I remember someone saying experiencing such like happy things and such awful things and
all
just
in the same
a
setting.
Huge amount of information.
You get numb to it after a while, you know?
Yeah.
Like you don't even know it's real and like real life things don't feel normal anymore.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I think about our kids. My kids, thankfully, they kind of live in a very sheltered life. We live on 11 acres and like they kind of just, they go outside and they're bare feet all the time and like it's great. But a lot of kids don't have that luxury. So like they're on tablets all the time and every time I go out to a restaurant, and no offense if anyone does this here, but like I get it, I'm very tempted to, but just having the constant like tablet while they're sitting down just to keep them quiet, just to keep them zoned out. To me, I'm just like, man, like that is so not good for a child. Right before they're about to eat a meal, that's going to be harder to digest. And it just creates a whole cascade of events. But people just, I'm the same way. Like I had chronic pain, chronic fatigue for about 10 years when I was younger. I know what it's like. Like I know how hard it is to change your ways and kind of start moving in a better direction. But it's easy to take ibuprofen for your pain and just to take and drink a bunch of caffeine for your energy and just to kind of keep kicking the can down the road. But I think for me, I came from a household that was very broken in terms of their health. Like my brother had leukemia. My mom had autoimmune issues because of a lot of different things that were happening in our household. My dad had multiple heart attacks. Like there was just a lot to happen within like a 10-year period. And it started affecting my health. And I think the question that I started to ask is just like, well, how do I break the cycle? Mm-hmm. Like there has to be a way to, like, I know what it's like to be unhealthy. Like, what does the opposite look like? And what are the things that we're not doing that we may need to do differently? And it's not going to your doctor and getting more prescriptions. Like there are a time and a place for that to happen to kind of maybe, you know, if you have a heart attack and you need a nitroglycerin to kind of keep you alive, like that's great. Or you get in a car accident, you need to be, you know, whatever procedure done, like that's great. But when we get reliant on these things, it's just a good way to, you know, just kind of shove off responsibility. Like we don't want to change ourselves. Like it's hard to make changes, especially if you have the whole society telling you that doesn't make a difference. Even if you do make changes, like this is just genetic or it's just environmental. Like there's something you can do about it. Like when the reality is, as Christians, we know that there are, you know, in Hosea 4, chapter 6, I think it's God saying it, but like my people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge. Like we have to learn these things. Like we have to figure out what is harming us. And then there's also this other conversation about iniquities. Iniquities are things that we do knowing that they're bad for us, but we do them anyway, right?
Yeah.
And so that's like, well, I'm going to eat this donut. I know it's not good for me, but I'm going to do it anyway. It's like whenever you start having those moments, like that's the time to start saying, okay, like if I know this is not good for me, I'm not going to do it, right? I'm just going to draw a line here and say like, I'm not going to do these things 90% of the time. Maybe occasionally you do, but if you're trying to fix a problem, you have to treat it like you're building a house. Like you can't just throw some wood up and some screws and some cement and hopefully the house is built. Like you have to follow a particular path of building it properly and make sure it's done right. Otherwise, it's just going to fall over. Like the same is true with your health. Like if you're trying to figure out what foods trigger you, you have to do an elimination diet. Like food sensitivity tests aren't very accurate. You're not going to be able to figure out what actually triggers your immune system. But if you do an elimination diet, you can walk through it over the course of about 6 weeks and you can get really good data on yourself as to how your body responds to certain things. And while you're doing that, you can then start to meet your nutrient deficiencies, get good sleep, drink good water, and next thing you know, you'll start seeing your body change. Like within less than 2 months. Like I'm telling you, like I've had people that have had years and years of problems that they saw no progress. They only saw a regression. And within like 4 to 6 weeks, they're like, I feel great.
Do they stay off those foods forever? Because I've heard some people say you need to add it back in. I've heard some people say that's where people get overwhelmed. You know, because I've eliminated certain foods from my diet and it's based off of how they made me feel.
Right.
But then you see these things where it's like, well, you should add these things back in. Eventually, it's not good for you to have so many foods eliminated. What's your opinion on that?
I think, if you just do the food stuff, it can be pretty confusing. If you're doing the food stuff while addressing like digestive enzyme insufficiency or low stomach acid or need for detoxification or parasite cleanses or heavy metal detox or mold detox, if you do all that stuff while you're doing the food stuff, it really can help to get at the root of why the foods were sensitive to begin with.
Yeah.
But if you're somebody that's eating ultra processed food expecting it to help you, like that's crazy, right? Like if you're eating real food that's been created by God that we've been eating for centuries, like that's going to serve you well, right? And we all know what those foods are, right? It's just when you get into these other foods of, hey, I'm eating pasta, but like these aren't ancient grains. These are hybridized wheat, hybridized proteins. You know, like my body doesn't even know what this is when it's coming in and I'm expected to have a normal response to it. Like that's never going to work for you. Or if you're eating dairy and it's ultra pasteurized, like all the good bacteria has been zapped out of it. And all you're left with is like the fat molecule that's too big to get filtered through your lymphatic system. And now you have congestion, you have, you know, achy joints. Like, so there's a way to do it. And it's not as clear cut of just saying like, don't eat any grains or don't eat any dairy. It's like, well, why would you have difficulty with that? And what kind of grains and dairy are you consuming? And is your body detoxing at a sufficient level on a daily basis? If it's not, you got to fix that problem before you can challenge it with these extra food challenges that can make it complicated.
What would you recommend for detox or good ways you can detox?
Yeah, it's not complicated, but the answer is, to say it correctly would be a little bit complicated. So I'll try to say it in a way that people don't go out and detox unsafely, I guess. But
yeah, speak to that because people always talk about it online, but if you detox incorrectly, you could actually make yourself more sick.
Yeah, you'll feel terrible. So you have to have a daily bowel movement. If you are constipated, you're not detoxifying at all. So that's the first thing. Like if you're going once every couple of days, I've had people that told me like once every couple of weeks, which yes, it's true. Yes.
That's awful.
It is awful.
That's
terrible.
Crazy.
And they get used to it. But you want to be having a bowel movement like once every 3 days. Every day you want to have 1 to 3 bowel movements is what you want to have, right? And so a lot of people don't get enough minerals in their water. They don't have enough magnesium in their water. So they're drinking, you know, diluted water that has no real purpose or benefit to it. And then they're eating foods that are backing them up, things like that. So like you gotta have a daily bowel movement. Magnesium citrate is typically what I recommend for that. Depends on the dosage. 200 to 400 milligrams is typically recommended.
How much fiber?
People get enough fiber, in my opinion, like if they're eating some veggies, right? Like if you're eating some veggies once a day and some fruit here and there, like you're gonna be getting enough fiber. So I don't really feel like people need to worry about that. It's more about their gastric motility, and gastric motility is influenced heavily by your thyroid and then your stress, right? And so if you're having hypothyroidism or just a sluggish thyroid, you're going to have sluggish bowels. And so a lot of women have hyperthyroid issues, so they have sluggish bowels. And so they drink caffeine to kind of get them going, but if they take out the caffeine, they slow down substantially. And then the other thing is just when you're eating food, if you're eating in a stressful environment or eating on the go, eating at a table or like standing up at a table instead of like sitting down, taking deep breaths, like engaging into your meal, that's going to be really hard for your digestive enzymes to be secreted fast enough for your body to then break it down quickly to then make sure it gets mobilized through your small intestine, then through colon and out. So it's really, it's foundational basic stuff, but you got to drink water. You got to slow down your nervous system a little bit. You got to take some deep breaths. Gargling before a meal can help. Humming before a meal can help to kind of stimulate your vagal nerve. But otherwise, it's not too complicated for most people, but some people have stomach acid issues, digestive enzyme issues that need to be addressed, but that's not most people. Yeah.
Is there any other ways of detoxing that you like?
Yeah, obviously hydrating with humic and fulvic acid are good ones. They're kind of like a toddler that could lift what a gorilla could lift. Like they're really small molecules that can bring heavy things in the cell and then get heavy things out of the cell. And so you can get humic and fulvic acid. A lot of supplement stores carry it now. It's a great mineral just to add to your water. Otherwise, NAC, glutathione, B vitamins, NAC, those can all be very helpful. Depending on what types of issues you're having, if it's like a parasite issue, there's like wormwood and clove and black walnut, things like that. It's all in my book. Like I have like this whole like step-by-step process that I'm referring to. And it's like an ebook, so it has like links and stuff in it that you can kind of like see these products and things I'm recommending. But it is like, there's like the diet aspect to it. There's like the detox aspect to it. But for most people, they don't move their body enough, they're dehydrated, they don't have a daily bowel movement, and they're just not sweating. You know, they're not moving enough to sweat. So like sauna can be great, infrared sauna, just moving your body, sweating, that kind of stuff.
What would your advice be to parents? What are the most important things for their kids?
Provide stability, you know, in the household. Don't treat it like a hotel. Allow for meals to take place. Allow for consistent bedtimes to take place. Feed them real food, you know.
What do you think about screen time at meals?
Absolutely not.
Okay, explain why.
Well, it gets back to that whole blue light thing and what it does to your nervous system and how it makes digestion much more difficult. And also, it's just like, if you can't have 30 minutes of being quiet as a family once a day, like talking to each other, like your family's not going to go in a good direction. Mm-hmm. Like it's like you act as like a little god to your little kids. Like they look up to you as that model, right? Mm-hmm. And so if we're not modeling what we want them to behave and do one day, it's like, where are they going to learn it from? Like they're going to learn it from watching the tablet. And I'm sure that tablet's indoctrinating them even more depending on what they're watching.
It's so true.
Yeah.
Okay, and so one of the things you do is you help people with their hormones.
Mm-hmm.
So why are most women estrogen dominant and struggling with progesterone?
If you're eating a diet that's processed and you're eating a lot of sugary foods, that's going to make estrogen levels typically rise. But then you compound it with the things you put on your skin, the things you're breathing in, the makeup, all that different stuff, and then just the clothes you wear, the foods you eat, all these have like estrogen mimicking effects to where they can basically, as far as a receptor site's concerned, they can kind of take up a receptor site spot, but they aren't like true estrogens. So they can kind of mimic estrogen and they like can create more of an estrogen dominant state within your body.
How do they do that? How does clothes do that? These are the phytoestrogens?
Yeah, it's phytoestrogens. It's depending on what, like polyester, whatever you're wearing.
Yes,
like,
speak to polyester because almost everything is polyester.
I know, everything's
especially
polyester.
Especially activewear, which is like what like me, all the moms wear. I didn't even know this. I was like wearing leggings for years while pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And then I found out later all this horrible stuff is in there. And I'm like, what on earth?
So to me, that's not as big of a deal.
Okay.
You know, it's like, that's like one of the, it's like if you have multiple components of these different categories, then it starts to create a vicious cycle or,
what are your worst hormone offenders?
Probably the makeup for sure.
Oh, wow.
Gosh. And don't get me asking like which makeups, because I don't, my wife uses, she does use a brand, but I don't know if I can say it on here, but she does use a brand. I got to get them to maybe like, you know, partner with me in some way.
Yeah.
She loves them. But anyway, there are clean makeups out there. You know, if you're eating a bunch of soy or like, I'm not sure what kind of candle this is, but if it's like a soy candle, like that's not great.
We could be offending right now in the studio.
Like this will make all of us men less manly just
don't
over time.
Don't blow it out. It's for all of us, honey.
No, but like things like that. So like those are some factors. But for most part, I would say insulin resistance becomes a big problem for a lot of women with estrogen. So when your insulin, which is your, so insulin's a hormone that is supposed to kind of regulate blood sugar and kind of different, like where blood sugar is supposed to go, where it's not supposed to go, how it's used, how it's not used. If you become insulin resistant because your body's constantly consuming a bunch of sugary foods, that will make you more likely to have things like PCOS and estrogen dominance.
Which is so common.
Yeah, like 1 in 10 women are having PCOS. And so, and like—
Why do you think we have so much insulin resistance now? Like, why is that such a big issue?
Well, it gets back to the inflammation issue I was discussing earlier, and then the foods, and then the circadian rhythm. Like, all these things that I've been talking about.
It all works together.
So, like, people always, my clients, I always work with women. I only work with women, but they're always like, when are we going to work on the hormones? I'm like, well, we've been working on hormones since day one. Because, like, if you're not sleeping, if you're not eating healthy, like, you're not doing all these things we just talked about, all your hormones, because it's a cascade— Like think about your thyroid at the top, and as it's really like a thyroid at the top, and as it cascades down towards your gonads, that's where you start to see the effects happen. So your sex hormones are like progesterone, estrogen, testosterone. They are the first ones to leave and the last ones to return. So they're kind of like if there's a bad situation happening, they're not needed for survival, right? Like they're needed for thriving, like making babies.
Wow!
But when you're under stress and your thyroid is just trying to keep you alive, it's not going to prioritize progesterone production. It's going to prioritize cortisol in your adrenal glands. And so people have to kind of start looking at their life in the terms of how am I adding stress in the survival sense of like, I'm not eating enough food. That's a stressor. I'm over-exercising. That's a stressor. I'm not sleeping. I'm eating not nutrient-dense foods. That's a stressor. And next thing you know, your body is stressed and it's going to prioritize storing fat and keeping you alive. And so that's where women start to see a big issue with their hormones because they're in survival mode.
Would you say fragrance is a worse offender than makeup?
Probably. Okay. I don't know for sure, but I would just guess. That'd be my guess, but I don't know.
I wasn't
for sure.
prepared for you to say makeup was one of the worser offenders.
Yeah. So there's a Hermosa study. I don't know when it was, maybe 2008. They're looking at like Latina girls that were in California, uh-huh. and they were using a bunch of different beauty products and fragrances and stuff. And the cool thing was, when they removed those products for like 6 days, their hormone levels improved by like 48% or something like that. Like they started to restore very quickly. So it's the good news is you can stop using it and your body will adapt pretty quickly. If you use it consistently, it becomes a big problem. But it is a combination, I think, of, you know, it depends on what's in the products. But like the fragrances, you're breathing them in, they're just getting in your skin. But the makeup, it's also absorbing through your skin. Your skin's like a big mouth. So whatever you put on it, it's going to absorb through your bloodstream. You know, same thing with sunscreen. Like people don't think about these things very, very much. But whatever you put on your skin, it's going to be a problem eventually. Nail polish is a big one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What would you say is contributing to infertility? Because so many women are struggling with that as well, men.
Yeah, all these things. I mean, we're at a rate now where we're not able to replace our population, not just the United States, but around the world. Like,
yeah, the birth gap.
Yeah, we're all kind of in big trouble.
I know no one knows about that either.
Yeah.
Like no one's talking about it. I think the majority of the world would say we have like a population issue is what they believe,
yeah,
and we have too many people. But they don't understand that if we don't have enough children to support our generation, we're going to be in a bad place. But no one's talking about that.
Yeah, I'm actually debating. I want to start a community for this whole thing. Like, I want to connect like singles to each other. I want to like connect like for families that already exist, like help them to support their fertility so they can have babies. For people that already have kids, help them to raise their kids well. For postmenopausal women who want to like be healthier for their grandchildren. Like, I want to do the whole thing. So like maybe this could be a little teaser for it. But like I want to kind of lead the way in that with whoever wants to help. But I think that's like going to help save the planet. Like not the planet, but like the people of the planet.
You know, it's
like,
true.
It's so necessary. But so all those things lead into, so I was saying before, your hormones are going to be the first ones to leave, last ones to return. So if you're in a stressful state, your body doesn't want to prioritize babies because it's trying to prioritize your own life, right? And so if you start to think about that, you have to then understand like, okay, if you have low progesterone, high estrogen, you don't make babies. And this is what's interesting. So women are taking on more male headship roles in our society, right? Like they're out in the workforce more, like they're taking on their financial responsibilities and the home responsibilities. Like it's a lot of responsibilities. You think about adaptively why that would, what would happen if somebody was doing that. And for a woman, she's going to become more like a man. Like
yeah.
She's going to have higher testosterone. She's going to have lower progesterone. And again, that's by adaptive design. Like it's going to help her get through, but that doesn't mean that she's in her thriving state. Like a woman that's in her thriving state can make babies no problem. She's in her fertile window often. And I think, it always gets back to progesterone and estrogen, and then it affects how it affects DHEA and FSH and luteinizing hormone, all those different things. But the big picture is that conversation.
What would you say for like a meal? Do you have like kind of a, where it's like this much protein, this much vegetable? Is there like kind of like a, what you would recommend to people?
So I usually want at least like 30, 35 grams of protein a meal. So the way to picture it is about 20% of your plates could be carbs, like complex carbs, like a sweet potato. Those are my favorite veggies because they're actually got ranked best vegetable, I think. They stabilize your blood sugar really well and they kind of help to provide some satiety. But then, so about 20% would be like something like that. And then maybe you think, 40% would be protein and 40% would be fat. So kind of picturing your plate like that. But the equivalent for your day for protein for a woman should be a minimum of like 100 grams of protein. So that's kind of picturing like 3 hamburger patties a day is like what would be a minimum. Depends on how much you're working out, how heavy you are, all those different factors. But that would be like a minimum requirement for women.
And people think, it's not until you start tracking this, you think that it's easy, but you have to be very intentional to get that much protein. There's no way that people, if they're just eating a standard diet, that they're eating that much protein. Because in most processed foods that people eat, there's no protein.
Right. Yeah, what I hear all the time is I eat yogurt with some berries, with some honey, after my coffee, with some cream, and then I have a salad for lunch, and then I have some like pasta and a little bit of hamburger for supper. And it's like, that's
a really low amount of protein.
Very low.
Yeah.
Or they think, you know, I'll eat some eggs, and eggs only have like 4 grams or 5 grams of protein.
Yeah, there's not that much protein in eggs.
And eggs are honestly a big problem for a lot of my clients, unfortunately, for autoimmune issues.
Really?
Because of the vaccines, especially the flu vaccine a lot of us had, there were egg proteins in there, and so it will trigger immune system response, and that's by design. So now when you eat eggs down the road, like you are sensitive to them or have allergies to them. So doing an elimination of eggs is really important for, it only takes like four to five weeks to do that, but you can do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's probably the most important, because eggs can be healthy if you eat good quality eggs, but if they're not good for you, you don't want to be eating them.
Yeah, and you know, I think people get overwhelmed. I know I felt this way about diet, because you'll get these people on and they're like, don't eat this, don't eat that, don't eat vegetables, don't eat almonds, don't eat that. And then you just kind of feel like overload.
Yeah.
But I feel like what I'm getting from you is, if you could just step away from ultra processed food. What do you think about protein powder?
It's hard to find a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't be where the bulk of your protein is coming from.
No, again, I want my clients to chew their food.
Yeah.
It's okay to add it at the end of your meal, just like as a little subsidy, but it's not, it shouldn't be a meal replacement. Yeah. And it's hard because a lot of proteins are whey-based proteins, which are, if you have a dairy sensitivity, that can be a problem for you. Pea protein can be a decent option. Hydrolyzed pea protein can be a decent option. Or hydrolyzed bovine protein can be a decent option. But they're harder to find. Most people aren't consuming that. And they're just drinking them down with a bunch of fruit and spinach and who knows what else. And it's just a big blood sugar spike and causes digestive issues. And it's hard to have a healthy gut with that kind of meal, quote unquote.
Yeah. And speaking of gut, any advice on how to kind of keep your gut healthy? Especially like if you've had antibiotics.
Yeah.
You strip all your good bacteria away.
Yeah. So what we do is they follow our diet. They cut all that stuff out that would make it difficult. We figure out if they have low stomach acid or not, which a lot of these clients do.
Is that a common thing?
Pretty common, yeah. Again, if you have a stressful life, you likely have lower stomach acid because your proton pumps are not going to be pumping out as much acid as they should, because it's prioritizing, again, survival. So it's not expecting you to eat, right? But if you're eating in a calm environment, you'll start to secrete stomach acid at a sufficient amount to where you can break things down.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people have acid reflux. It's not because they have too much acid. It's because they don't have enough acid to break it down quickly enough. And so they start getting food that gurgles up and puts pressure on their esophageal sphincter, and then they get like acid reflux coming out.
Yeah. Oh, but I've never heard about the whole being calm.
Really?
Well, yeah, you're the first person I've heard.
Also, don't drink
that.
Water while you're eating meals. That also affects your stomach acid and your digestion. So,
and doesn't sparkling water, isn't that even like a worse offender?
Yeah, it's carbonated.
Oh,
so it just takes up space, right? So like the more space it takes up, the less churning ability your stomach has to break things down. So it's not just like your stomach acid is like more acidic, I think, than dog's stomach acid in humans. So it's very, very acidic, but it's a micro change that will make a big difference, especially if it's consistently. So you got to have good stomach acid. You got to chew in a calm environment. Make sure you're chewing your food. It takes about 20 minutes for CCK, which is this chemical that tells you that you're full, to be released. And so once that happens, you can realize that you're satiated, you're not hungry anymore, and then you can like let your food digest, go on a walk, and then you can have some water a little bit later after that. But if you do those things routinely, within like 3 to 5 days, your stomachs or your intestinal cells are being remade new. Mm-hmm. And so like they're trying to heal, but if you're constantly giving them the wrong material and then they don't have the enzymes to help them do what they're supposed to do, they just get broken down so quickly you can't really get ahead of it. But if you do it consistently, eat the right foods, do the right process, like your gut will start to heal pretty quick. Like we see it happen all the time.
Oh, that's awesome.
First step, yeah.
Okay, what are your thoughts on getting colonics and enemas?
I think it's a good option if you've tried all those other things and they haven't worked. I don't think they're a great first line of defense or intervention. I think there's simpler things and like lifestyle things that you need to be doing anyway. Like if you just do the colonics and enemas and then you don't change anything else, you're gonna need to keep doing them, right? Like, they can't be a good reset, but you have to like
dependent on them.
Yeah, you have to like figure out what you're doing wrong that would cause you to need that, right? But if you can do that while you're doing that, then it's fine. I would say it's not a big deal. Yeah.
Okay, guys, I just have to ask this as a woman. I feel bad asking this. Are tampons bad for women?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of
even
them.
Even the clean ones?
It depends on if it's a cleaner
product.
Sorry,
guys, I just have to ask this as a woman.
It depends on what's in them, right? So I'll go as far as say that this affects everybody, but toilet paper is.
I told you.
It's just. So we use like bamboo toilet paper or a duvet, or what's it called? A duvet?
A bidet.
Yeah, we use a bidet. But it's like that toilet paper and the tampons, all those chemicals that we're all referring to, if these these forever chemicals, they're all in these products. And so you're putting them right in sensitive areas. And to me, that's just like you're asking for it. So again, in the big picture, you have to kind of focus on the things that you can control. If you can control what tampons you buy or toilet paper you buy, then like I would recommend that. But don't stress about it every night, you know.
And then what would you say for supplements to help with hormone? Are there any that you like to recommend?
Yeah, so the foundational ones are, so about 68% of the population is deficient in omega-3s, or omega-3s to omega-6 fatty acid ratio is way out of balance. So it's supposed to be like a 1-to-1, 1-to-2 ratio of omega-6s to omega-3s. We're like a 1-to-20 ratio in society. Like I've never had a patient or a client that had normal ratios of omega-3s. Like we're so out of whack there. Mm. And omega-3s are critical for the production and the conversion of your hormones. So you have
really?
Cholesterol. Yeah, cholesterol is your starting point for your hormones. Then it goes to pregnenolone. That conversion from cholesterol to pregnenolone and then to progesterone all relies on a couple things, but primarily omega-3 fatty acids. And so that would be the first one, is make sure you're on a quality omega-3. It should have a dose of 600 milligrams of EPA and DHA per capsule, or per two capsules, I guess. So that'll be the first one. Take them with a meal. And then the second one would be a B
complex.
You
like cod liver oil?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
But it's
I don't
not
like the taste of it, but I mean, it's
awful.
I like it. Yeah. There's a couple good ones out there, but I just like the capsules just to swallow personally.
So fish oil is good for hormones. Mm-hmm. What other supplements are good that you like to recommend?
So a lot of women have MTHFR, which you're probably familiar with that.
Oh yeah.
So
that's a gene.
Yep, it's a gene.
Gene mutation. Yeah.
Yeah. It basically makes your body so you can't methylate, right? And so methylation is this process that's happening like 300 billion times a day. Like it's very important, and it feeds into basically every system you can imagine in your body. Like mm-hmm. it's your mental health, it's your sleep, it's your digestive health, it's your heart health, it's everything, energy production. And so if you don't methylate and then you're consuming a diet that's full of folic acid, which they fortify—
Which is in everything.
Which is in everything. They fortify all these foods that we're consuming, especially cereals and grains. Now all of a sudden you have this functional folate deficiency because you have enough folic acid, but folic acid is synthetic and it's terrible for people with MTHFR. So now you can't detox even more, and it creates this very vicious cycle. So stop eating folic acid, take a methylfolated or a B-complex supplement. And some people don't do well with methylated forms, so they may need to take a different form, but you can do a test to figure out kind of where you are. So I'd recommend getting a test before you just start taking stuff. But typically a methylated B-complex is what I would recommend for women with their hormones if they can tolerate it.
Mm-hmm.
And that helps tremendously with their thyroid, with their energy, with their detox.
Oh, yeah.
Especially on their cycle.
Game changer.
Yeah.
Just from personal experience.
Yeah, got to have that one. Magnesium's another big one. Obviously, upping before your menstruation starts, you know, taking magnesium glycinate is one I'd like to recommend, but you can take other forms as well. And then obviously vitamin D, that is a hormone as well. So like if you're low in vitamin D because you're not getting enough sunlight exposure, UV activation within your system, vitamin D is critical for, gosh, like every
yeah.
pathology. I mean, it's connected to so many different things. So you should be definitely above 50 with your vitamin D. They'll say above 30, 32, but I prefer people to be around like 60, 65 with their vitamin D levels. And so you can get a test to see where you are. If you don't know where you are, you can supplement. I read different things. I usually start with about 5,000 IUs a day mm-hmm. with vitamin K2 and magnesium. And
yeah,
you
have to take those together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I can explain that, or I can just kind of keep rolling on, whatever you prefer.
You can explain it.
Yeah. It's just, so vitamin D, if you don't have enough vitamin K or magnesium, you'll start to, it looks for things like calcium, other minerals to convert.
Mm-hmm.
And so it'll start to rob these other minerals from like places like your bones, and you start getting like calcifications in your arteries and things like that. So you really want to make sure you have K2 to kind of balance that out, so the calcium stays where it's supposed to be, the phosphorus stays where it's supposed to be, and then you're not calcifying your arteries, which is, and also your joints too. It can cause a lot of joint pain if you're not taking it properly. So that's a big one there, but those are probably the top four I typically recommend. In the actual hormone section of my ebook, like I talk more specifics, like depending on what type of problem you have, if it's a PCOS or endometriosis or infertility, I kind of get more specific there, but it just kind of depends on what you're dealing with.
Yeah, because different ones help with different
issues. I wouldn't recommend DIM to people that have low estrogen, you know, like, so there's kind of different.
Are there people with low estrogen? I guess
Yeah, especially as you get older, because I work a lot of postmenopausal women as well. And so
yes.
Their estrogen starts getting really low, then they have the opposite problems. So it's like
wow.
a fluctuation. Mm-hmm.
How do you test people? Do you do the Dutch testing?
Dutch testing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great test.
Oh, it's
for
great.
People who are looking for a provider and, you know. Yeah. That's the one I've heard.
Yeah. If you're going to check hormones, definitely do a Dutch test. It's a urine sample, so you can test it about 4 to 5 times throughout the day. So it's a lot more accurate. Blood is not as accurate when looking at those metabolites. You just can't get a good reading on them. But Dutch test is a good way to go.
Okay. Can you explain to the men for the women? Because men have about a 24-hour cycle for their hormones. It's so different from women. We have a 28-day cycle.
Yeah.
And so can you kind of explain to them what's going on with women so they know that we're not crazy?
Yeah. No, I mean—
all the women are laughing in the studio.
So I think the big thing to pay attention to is first of all, just if you ask your spouse, like, hey, where are you in your cycle, if you don't mind me knowing that information, and then— if you kind of know, like, hey, they're just starting menstruation day 1 through 7 or day 1 through 5.
Rough.
It can be rough. Yeah. It doesn't have to. My clients, the goal is always to get them they're surprised that they had their cycle, but that's not always the case. But if you know that, like, hey, they're in the beginning of their cycle, we should probably take it easier. Like, we shouldn't be having a lot of, like, intense exercise, or we should probably be going on, like, nice walks, nice calm things, not going crazy. And then between, like, 7 to, you know, maybe 18, 20, those days of the month, you can be more intense, like have higher intensity exercise. That would be a good time to maybe, if you're going to do any fasting, look at doing some fasting, do strength training, all that stuff. But you don't want to be doing that stuff at the beginning or the end of your cycle. You want to make sure that's kind of left for the middle of your cycle. So just—
Can you strength train? Because like, I have done it in that part of my cycle, but I'm not like doing it super intense.
Yeah, it's all about intensity.
Okay.
It's all about your intensity and how you recover. So if you feel like, hey, I'm recovering pretty well, I'm not pushing myself super hard, then like you can kind of make an intuitive decision on that. But yeah, it's not that you want to stop moving. It's just you don't want to be very intense. Like keep your intensity
like
lower.
How much you're sweating, how much output, you know.
Yeah, you can track your heart rate.
Intensity.
You know, like a zone 2 training style is like maybe 115 beats per minute to like 125 would be like a good spot to be for while you're training. But yeah, it does. You just don't want to get super intense, like running a bunch of marathon training or lifting super heavy. Like you just want to kind of think about it in that way.
And that's where men and women are different.
Oh, yeah.
And women can't do things just like men, or it's going to put stresses on if we're not the right place of our cycle.
Yeah. Yeah. You guys are meant to be cherished and you're sacred. And it's not like, you know, men have different roles. Like we have a different responsibility. Like that's why our hormones are very stable until basically we die. Like they maintain pretty well. And that's, you know, as my friend told me once, like men pull straighter with a heavier load. We're like a trailer. Like we just kind of do well with more responsibility.
Mm.
But
wow.
I think oftentimes our society encourages men to become more feminine and like pass off that responsibility. And women are trained to take it on and grab it, you know?
It's been this weird flip.
Yeah, since Adam and Eve. Like that's literally what happened in Adam and Eve. Like it's been since the beginning of time.
Yeah, so and it's had an uptake even in the last like about 50 years, probably since like the sexual revolution, like the
60s and 70s.
Yeah.
That's when birth control became popular.
Birth control. Can you just speak to birth control?
Yeah, don't
bad,
take
bad,
it.
Bad.
Yeah, if you don't, I mean, there's—
Awful for you.
There's really no reason that you would have to take it, right? Like I can see why you are taking it to help eliminate ovulation and control symptoms, but it's not going to fix anything. And if you're doing it just not to have a baby, like there are other ways to not have a baby. If you don't know that, like I can give more details about that, but you don't have to get pregnant. You know, you can avoid that stuff. But even still, it's just not worth the risk. Like I think it depletes vitamin or B6. It depletes copper, which is important for basically everything. It can also cause copper toxicity if you take a copper IUD. So it kind of creates a different problem.
Because people think that's like the non-hormone, but that causes different issues.
It's a different type of problem, yeah. And so the short answer is, yeah, like it disrupts all your hormones. Ovulation is like the peak of your cycle, right? Like that's when you feel your best. And so if you're taking that out, you're kind of like neutralizing the peak feeling of a female. And like that to me is just like criminal. I don't know why we're doing that. But people do it because they have crazy bleeding or they have terrible symptoms, PMS, and so like it helps them short term, but then it starts creating more problems and they get like a hysterectomy down the road because they have all these other issues like, you know, fibroids and endometriosis, and it's like, well, I guess it's just genetic or whatever, but the reality is it probably started back when they got birth control and they never fixed the problems that they were doing to themselves or that they were exposed to, and then they just kind of create this vicious cycle. So it can be stopped though. It's definitely something that can be prevented and stopped and reversed.
What would you say for men with testosterone, since so many men are suffering with low testosterone?
I mean, we got to lift heavy. We got to get out there and be in the sun. Like, we got to eat meat. Like, we got to do the things that, like, you think of a lumberjack doing. Like, those are the things. You got to stop breathing candles, you know, that are full of soy and whatever else. And I think a lot of it, alcohol is a huge one. You know, like, just being real with it. Like, alcohol is going to trash your sleep. It's going to trash your testosterone output. But again, testosterone is the same kind of thing. Like, if you're stressed, it's going to start converting into estrogen. like it kind of starts moving in this other direction. Like we start getting like, you know, man chest and or all that kind of stuff that's not super appealing.
It's a no-no.
Yeah, it's no-no. So,
and alcohol, I'm glad you're saying that. There's no benefit to alcohol.
There's really none.
Really.
Yeah.
And I think they tried to kind of push that so many years ago. But I think now the people are coming out, like Huberman's coming out. He's like, there's really no good amount of alcohol, like none that's okay for you.
And I would say caffeine too. You know, caffeine, there's a healthy limit of caffeine. Like too much caffeine is going to do the same thing that does to women. It's going to put you in that fight or flight state. It's going to raise cortisol, and that's going to end up depleting cortisol or testosterone a little bit too. So it's not like if you're drinking over, you know, if you're drinking like a three cups a day, like 600 milligrams a day, like that's probably too excessive. If it's under that 200 milligrams a day, you're probably fine, you know.
I'm calculating right now.
It just kind of depends on what you're drinking. If it's like a Monster, like those kind of energy drinks, like that's got different things in it that makes it even worse. But caffeine's a big one. Alcohol's a big one.
What about sweeteners? What ones are you okay with and not okay with?
Stevia. I was just talking to somebody about stevia and how that's going to be causing so many infertility issues.
You're the second person to say that.
Yeah.
Darn it.
I know.
That's been the alternative sweetener.
So
just think everything.
Just think monk fruit, you know, maple syrup and, you know, like honey. Like those are your sweeteners from God. Like you don't need to add these artificial things.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh.
Okay.
I feel like I'm making things worse here.
You're not making things worse. I'm only saying that I'm looking at everyone because stevia was very popular here because we were told it was okay. And now we're finding out, and you're like the second person to say it causes fertility issues.
It can. I mean, a lot of these artificial sweeteners, again, because of how your body interprets it as like a foreign invader coming into your system.
Really?
It can create immune system challenges. But whenever you're thinking fertility, you just have to think of what's my inflammation like? Like if I have high inflammation, I likely have fertility problems. Like if it's stretched out long enough, you'll start seeing that happen. So,
okay, we have to almost wrap. Number one inflammation offenders, what would you say, top ones?
Oh my gosh. As far as food or just in general?
In general.
Oh, that's so hard. I'll talk about this because we haven't talked about this, but mold is a big issue. So depending on where you live, it's not as big of an issue, but mold is becoming a bigger and bigger issue that people are starting to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's so sneaky in how it disrupts your system. Same with heavy metals. And so I would say heavy metals and mold would probably be the two things that people aren't used to hearing that is probably at the root of a lot of these things. If you have them in high doses in your system and they're trapping in your fat cells and trapping in your organs, you won't see them on a lab test unless you test for them specifically. And so then that would be the big one to kind of leave you guys with. It's just like, you got to check those things and make sure you're checking parasites. I threw that one in there last. Parasites, heavy metal, and molds. Like that's where I would check.
Okay. Well, this has been amazing. Thank you so much.
Yeah,
for people
of course.
Who want to know more, get more information, like your ebook, where do they go?
Yeah, you can just go to holy.health. So it's WHOLLY.health/book. And you can find my book or you can just find my website or find me on Instagram at dr.austin.lake.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Austin.
Of course,
Austin.
Appreciate it. Yeah, it was fun.